Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Gretchen McCulloch.
And I'm Lauren Gawn. And in this Patreon bonus episode, we get excited about, like, all the different uses of like. But first, thanks to everyone who came along to our live recording all about sweary swear words.
And if you didn't head it live, it was also in your feed as the May bonus episode.
It was so lovely to see so many of you in the Discord and to hear you share your stories about swearing.
Lauren, do you want to hear about one of my favorite papers?
I would love to hear about one of your favorite academic linguistics papers.
Yes, I have many papers that I like in linguistics. This one is a paper that's all about the word like in English and all of the things people think about it.
I'm very excited for this.
It's a really fun paper. I am a proud like user, as I believe you are too. And this is a paper by a linguist named Alexandra Darcy, who's a Canadian.
Is this another reason why it's one of your favorite papers?
I mean, I can't deny that some nationalistic sentiment may have gotten into it. And the thing I found, I think, very validating about this paper is, so I first read it about 7 years ago, and reading through it because, you know, I'm a like user, and she's describing, here are all the things people do with like, and here are the different sort of ages and like demographics and how like in various uses has spread and changed and like has different age effects depending on which of the functions it has.
Yep.
And I've just found it so validating because I was like, yeah, this feels accurate to me as a speaker. This feels like something that I'm doing. And it makes all these points about all of the sort of subtle stuff that's going on. And it just feels like somebody's finally seeing some of the stuff that I'm doing.
It's not just a paper about a topic in grammar that we both use all the time, but it's also incredibly well written, beautifully researched, really amazingly well laid out. And that's why we've both read through the article and we're going to share a bit of an overview on why it's such a compelling article.
It's a great example of like the fine delicacy of academic shade. The title is Like and Language Ideology, Disentangling Fact from Fiction. And the fiction parts, where it's like people believe this, but actually here's this entire study about why they're wrong. Or media narratives are like this, but actually there's this far more complicated thing going on. I just find it very satisfying. And it's this very sort of polite kind of everybody's wrong
here. It's very well written. It does come across as just like very academic prose unless you know how to read for the signs of a scholar who has all the receipts.
Amazing. We should also point out that Alex Darcy has written a whole bunch of different things about the word like. She wrote her PhD dissertation about it back in the day. She has a book about it. She's written various articles about it. This is a particular article that I like about it. But first of all, you could absolutely make an academic career kind of off a single word if that word is as interesting and complicated as like is. And also, there's more scholarship where that comes from if you're somebody who's like, wow, I never thought about how interesting this is. I really want to dive into all of this. I will say it's an academic book. I haven't read the whole thing, but it is sort of an academic monograph. And if you don't know as much about theoretical linguistics, like, hey, that's what we're for, to read some of that and talk about it. So, you know, maybe she'll write at some point a pop linguistics book about like, I think she'd be a great person for the job, but she hasn't yet done that. So it's a lot of academic stuff at the moment.
So today we have read Darcy, 2007, Like and Language Ideology, Disentangling Fact from Fiction, which was in the journal American Speech, issue 84, and it was published in 2007.
One thing that's interesting about a paper like this is, so it's published in 2007, it's based on work from her dissertation, which was published in 2005, and so a lot of the corpora were created in 2002 and 2003. So it's very convenient to read now because when she's talking about people in their 20s, you can just add 20 years and like these are people in their 40s. When she's talking about people who are teens, these are people who are in their 30s now. When she's talking about people who are in their 50s, again, you could add 20 years. And so it makes the math really easy to calculate when talking about different age groups.
And also a good reminder that it does take a few years to get from collecting data to writing up a thesis to publishing parts of that thesis as journal articles. The academic pace is sometimes not that speedy, but we're going back in time to visit what was happening 20 years ago.
And I think the other cool thing about the ages is that, as Darcy points out at the beginning of the paper, a lot of previous research on like had only surveyed teenagers or young people. And so they were saying, well, it's a young people thing, but that was because they were only looking at young people. Whereas this article is working from a data set that has people in age bands from 10 to 12 at the bottom, all the way up through in graduated bands to 80 plus.
And as a bit of foreshadowing, maybe it's not as much of a young people phenomenon as earlier studies and assumptions had shown, which is a really great example of not pre-biasing your data collection.
Yeah, absolutely. So that part's fun, and you have all these nice age bands sort of all the way through, and you're able to get these nice graphs of like, okay, if something's increasing among 30-somethings and then it really increases among 20-somethings and is, you know, high still among teens, then you can do what linguists call an apparent time graph, which is sort of like, imagine you were doing like a 100-year research project where every year or every few years you would go out and survey the same age group, say teenagers, and then 10 years later you survey current teenagers again, and 10 years later you survey current teenagers again. And this would obviously be super interesting, but it's also kind of a massive project for one person to do, especially given sort of the average human lifespan. So
indeed.
Another version of that study is you can do, okay, if we survey a whole bunch of ages now, and we can assume that maybe what the 80-year-olds are doing now is like what people would have been doing 70 years ago or 60 years ago when those people were teens. So this idea of an apparent time graph where you sort of use older people as a proxy for former teenagers is very common in sociolinguistics in general. This isn't something that Alex Darcy is inventing, but this is a good example of seeing different kinds of uses of like increase in different types of groups of the population, depending on sort of what's going on.
Tell me more about this different kinds of uses of like. It's just one word, Gretchen.
Aha, aha. You see, you have fallen into a very clever trap. So this is something I think that was super satisfying for me reading this paper when I first read it, where I was like, yeah, there are lots of uses of like. So there's 9 that are listed in this paper.
5 of them you're likely to see if you look up a dictionary or a grammar of English. They are long-standing, hundreds if not thousands of years old uses. Things like using it as a verb. I don't really like her that much is the friendly example that Darcy has in her paper.
Right. And same with there's a noun. He grew up with the likes of all great fighters.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the likes of me. Yeah. There's the adverb use. It looks like a snail. It is a snail.
And then the conjunction. So it felt like everything had dropped away.
And then there's the like as a suffix. So I went mumbling or something stroke-like. So that's what you could call the suffix-like use of like.
I haven't even really paid attention to how many long-established uses of like there were. But that accounts for only 5 of the 9 uses. The other 4 are these more informal and vernacular forms that therefore haven't necessarily made their way into standard descriptions of English.
Right. And the very diplomatic phrase that Alex Darcy uses is 4 uses that draw attention in vernacular speech. Which is the very polite way of saying that people write angry news articles op-eds about.
They do indeed draw attention. Which, like, it might be worth just pausing here briefly and saying there's every chance that for this episode, you are very aware of our different uses of like. It is something that is in both of our speech. I know we use it across a whole bunch of different episodes, but it might be particularly apparent to you now because it is also the topic of conversation.
I am definitely very self-conscious of my use of like right now. And every time I'm saying it, I'm like, no, here it is. I'm saying it. Am I intending to be saying it in this context? Am I, you know, what's it doing here? Which one am I using right now? So I don't know if I'm using it more or less, but
it's a really great reminder of the frequency illusion. You will notice something more if it's being called to your attention. So congratulations for your brain working in a way that recognizes the frequency illusion.
Thank you. But also there's another illusion, which is the recency illusion, which is often when you notice something about language, you start thinking, oh, maybe this is new and recent. And it's really just like you've started paying attention to it. And so you see it everywhere now. And it's already been going sometimes for hundreds of years. So this is one of the things that comes up with like as well, where just because you start noticing this use of it doesn't mean that they're necessarily all as old or young.
So let's meet our 4 vernacular uses of like.
Okay.
They all have very technical linguistic descriptive terms that Darcy groups them in, but we'll give you how they're used to get a sense of the differences.
So the first one, I think this one is sort of fairly familiar, is the use of like as a quotative be like.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the, and I was like, and he was like, and she was like, and they were like. that introduces a quotation. And one of the cool things about the quotative like, so it contrasts with things like, and I said, or, and I answered, or I replied, or I wondered, I asked.
Mm-hmm.
But it can also be used to represent mental states or cognitive processes or emotional reactions that aren't necessarily what you're actually saying out loud.
It's not what you're saying out loud. It's not necessarily a direct quote.
Mm-hmm.
If I say, and then she was like, get in the bin. I'm not necessarily committing to the fact they were her exact words. She might have just been generally disapproving.
Right. Or if somebody tells me really shocking news and I was like, what? I can't even believe you. I sometimes see people, and I've done this myself, say, and I was like this, but to be clear, I actually did say this, or, and I was like this, but, you know, inwardly I was like this, outwardly I was like that, and sometimes they're very different.
I don't know how I would get through a compelling narrative without quotative like.
And also, as I'm sure you've done, Lauren, you can use quotative like with gestures.
Absolutely. It's that flexible. I could say, I was like, and then do a giant shocked face for the shocking news that I'm reporting about.
Or sort of, and I was like, shrug.
Yeah.
You know, or, and I was like, woo, you're doing sort of woo gestures. You know, all of these are sort of available to you where, and I said, you can't really put a gesture there in that context. So yeah, I'm a big fan of quotative like. It's really fun. It's extremely versatile. And then there's another one which we can think of as approximative like.
Mm-hmm.
So the example that Darcy has is, it could have taken you all day to go like 30 miles.
Oh, yes.
You know, it was like 104 degrees. And this one contrasts with the word about. So you could replace it with, it takes you all day to go about 30 miles. It's about 104 degrees. But also, I think of this use of like as sort of like the like a skirt like.
Yeah.
So if somebody says like, oh, what are you wearing to the party? And I'm like a skirt. And it turns out I show up in a dress or dressy pants or something. I haven't lied to them. I've just said I'm wearing something sort of in the ballpark of a skirt. It doesn't commit to I'm wearing necessarily a skirt, as in I have a specific skirt in mind that I'm going to wear.
You can step a few steps away from the prototypical thing that it's referencing. And again, that wonderful flexibility makes it such a great addition to my narrative vocabulary.
And I think there, it's also more flexible than about, because I don't think I can say about a skirt. Like, you can use that about for numbers, like 30 miles is very similar to about 30 miles, but saying, what are you going to wear about a skirt doesn't quite track for me.
No. Something approximating a skirt sounds a little bit too formal.
I mean, you could say it if you want. Something in the ballpark of a skirt is just, you know, I'm really not committing to very much here. I'm being very specific. Or, you know, what do you want to eat? Like pizza. It doesn't necessarily commit me to eating only pizza. It just makes me want to eat things that are sort of in the neighborhood of pizza. But again, I don't think I can say like about pizza in that context.
The other two functions of like that Darcy has both broadly fall into a category of being used to structure discourse, so how we converse or tell a story. The first one is a marker, which links sentences. So it goes at the start of a sentence in much the same way that other English markers like so or then or well do.
Yeah, so there's this example that she has, like, one of my cats meows so much because, like, he's really picky and everything. And you could replace those two initial likes, one with I mean and you know. I mean, one of my cats meows so much because, you know, he's really picky and everything. And that comes across as effectively the same meaning of the sentence. It's doing things to link something with what's previously said or what's coming next. It's sort of linking those pieces together.
And that's distinct from the particle function where it highlights specific phrases within a sentence.
Yeah. So the particle is things like, oh, it was like boots we wore, or we stayed at like a motel. They were like living like dogs. I'm not sure if my 8-year-old like understands that. I think the interesting thing about these examples, which I definitely produce all kinds of stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
is that it doesn't really make sense to substitute something like I mean there. So at first, I was sort of skeptical of like, why are those two different discourse categories? And like calling them marker and particle aren't especially distinctive terms.
Yeah.
Sometimes people use discourse particle and discourse marker as practically synonyms. I know I've used them as practically synonyms before. But there is actually a distinction between how these two things function, because saying like, it was only like a step up, or they were like living like dogs. You can't substitute that with they were, I mean, living like dogs, or they were, you know, living like dogs. Like, that's not quite the same thing as I mean, one of my cats meows so much, which is the example of the thing where you can substitute it. Or something like, I'm not sure if my 8-year-old like understands that. I'm not sure if my 8-year-old, I mean, understands that. That doesn't work for me as a sentence.
It really highlights why like has been used as a resource in this way, because of this something close to but not exactly meeting the thing that I'm discussing is such a convenient thing to be able to package into this one short monosyllable.
Yeah, and I think there's some overlap with how people use words like and ah, where they're sometimes used in, again, this very sort of discoursey function to indicate that you're not finished talking yet, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a useful thing to do. But saying something like, I'm not sure if my 8-year-old understands that, that communicates something different from, I'm not sure if my 8-year-old like understands that.
Yeah.
Even though these are both discoursey things, what they're doing discourse-wise is different. Like is introducing this sort of approximative use, you know, is it understands? Is it fully comprehends? Is it has a vague approximation of understanding? Whereas the is doing this sort of pause to create effect, I guess, or maybe a sarcastic reading. I don't know what the is doing there.
It's a good reminder that just because two words can be in the same spot in a sentence and be in the same part of the grammar, they're still bringing their own meaning to that spot, and you can't just substitute them to get exactly the same meaning.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly for these discourse uses, like the markers that are at the beginning of the sentence and you can substitute them for you know and I mean and stuff, those are linking things together. But the particles, the ones that are in the middle of the sentence that are really hard to substitute for, they're often communicating interpersonal things, like checking or expressing understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And Darcy cites several studies around what kinds of impressions people have of using or not using these particles, that they can generate a sense of sharing or intimacy between people, or interactions where particles don't occur can be perceived as unnatural, awkward, dogmatic, or even unfriendly.
A good timely reminder that we do neaten up the edges of a Lingthusiasm episode when it comes to editing, but we do have to leave discourse markers in, partly because they're often in the middle of sentences and you can't cut them out, but also because it would feel really stilted for us to talk with no likes or no ums in the way that we speak.
And I think, you know, a pro in terms of using it is that speakers are rated as significantly more attractive, cheerful, and friendly when they use like as opposed to when they did not.
Amazing. Here's one easy tip to be more attractive to people. It's a great selling point.
It's a great selling point. And I think that's something that sort of gets overlooked in some of the sort of media narratives around like. It's think is like, well, everyone should try to sound like an edited book all the time. But people who are using like, whether consciously or not, are paying attention to, yeah, this makes you seem more friendly, more cheerful, more like you're paying attention to the needs and feelings of other people.
So here are our four functions of like that get used in conversation as a quotative, used as some kind of approximative, and it has its two marker and particle uses as discourse roles.
Yeah, so it gets used for linking things in the discourse, and then it gets used for sort of connecting with people more in the discourse.
And now that we have a really good understanding of the different ways people can use like, we can return to some of these myths that Darcy mentions in the title of the article.
The first myth that she mentions is this idea that like sort of goes anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that like is really versatile, but there are examples of places where it doesn't make sense to put it. And also, depending on where people are putting it, it means different things and it's expressing different types of things. So that's the thing we were talking about where all of the different spots that it goes. It's a lot more complicated than, oh, you can just stick it anywhere in the sentence. It's doing these sorts of different types of functions depending on where you put it. And it doesn't make sense to just put it anywhere.
And each of those four functions has its own grammatical rules within that. So we can go down and figure out if it's doing the quotative function, you can't just put it in at the end because a quotative has to go before the thing that you're quoting or reporting.
And that's really interesting because with say, I can say something like, you know, Lauren said the following things, or I can say the following thing said Lauren. But I have to say Lauren was like this, but it can't be like something was what Lauren was like. Like, I have to do a lot of syntax to make that happen.
That word say, it can go anywhere.
Yeah. Whereas like, be like, quotative like, very reliably goes before introducing what someone's saying and not after what they said, even though you can do that with other types of verbs of saying in English.
Our next myth is that it's women who use like all the time. One of the things I think it's worth pointing out at this point is we've been using a lot of examples straight from Darcy's article, and these have been from recordings of speakers in Toronto and some other places, but they've been a mix of examples from men and women. Because we've been reading them in our voices. This might be a bit of a surprise at this point, but she's made sure she's had a really good spread of men and women, which are the only categories she's coded in this data using like.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to do, you know, a future study with non-binary people and see what would show up there. But the thing that's interesting there is that there's a sort of media perception that like is a, you know, young women use it all the time. But actually, depending on the function, you get different gender effects. So for the quotative like, women tend to use it a bit more. For the particle like, which is, again, the one sort of in the in the middle of the sentence, I'm not sure if my 8-year-old like understands that. That's a 46-year-old man who's saying that. They were like living like dogs. That's a 52-year-old man who's saying that. So this is something that you tend to see a little bit more skewing male. And for the other two uses, there isn't a statistically significant gender effect there. So it's more complicated than, oh, this is a young woman thing, especially if you're viewing like as this undifferentiated mass of all of the likes are the same. There's, you know, four different likes, even if we're just looking at the newer ones.
And when we say there's a statistically significant difference between the men and the women, across a day, the chances you would actually attend to or notice that difference, unless you had this preconception, is actually incredibly low. It's not that women are using it four times more. For some of them, they're using it like 10% more.
Exactly. Like, you can find a statistically significant difference, but it's quite small. Like, all of the genders are using it, and the differences between which types of likes are being used are greater than the differences between genders. So there's a lot of other stuff going on there, and largely the story is just not a gendered one.
So maybe it's a young people thing.
Ooh, the next myth. So I think partly the fun thing here is you need to add 20 years to everybody's ages in this study because the data was being collected about 20 years ago. And so the stuff that's about teenagers who are doing this thing, these are 30-somethings now. The 20-somethings who are doing this thing are 40-somethings now. And I think, you know, maybe there's gotten a little bit less sort of media panic about young people using like these days because it gets kind of hard to claim that something's a young person thing when like 50-somethings are doing it. I think the media panic has moved on to other topics, unfortunately.
And it's very much a part of our professional register as we go about our lives. I certainly don't actively choose to not use it in certain contexts. It's very much just part of my variety of English now.
Right.
But I think this speaks to this recency illusion that we talked about earlier.
And the other thing, and the reason why it's useful to differentiate between these different functions, is that the discourse marker function, where the like at the beginning of the sentence or the phrase, things like my neighbors and we got on fine, the person who has that quote in this corpus is 78 in 2002. So, like, this person is, like, 98 around now. Like, this is just...
It's a young people thing, said the 105-year-old.
Here's somebody, like, it was kind of a wee bit of a tongue twister, who's 89 at the time of the study. And again, you know, this person's 109 if they're still around. It's really hard to claim that's a young person thing.
But maybe it's because they're American and it's an American thing, I say in my myth voice.
Great myth voice. There's also these really fun examples from rural England and from rural New Zealand. And there was a recordings of elderly speakers made by the New Zealand National Broadcasting Service in 1946. And they document the speech of New Zealanders who were born in the period from 1851 to 1919. And most of these speakers' parents had emigrated to New Zealand from England, Ireland, and Scotland. None had come from the US. And they're saying things like until his death, he used to write to me quite frequently. Or, like, you'd need to see the road to believe it. And these are people who were born in the 1870s.
You really just want to drive home the illusion part of the recency illusion, don't you?
Yeah. Here's somebody saying, you know, like, you'd be going into the hotel to stay for a day or two, born in 1886. You know, these people are dead now. It's not a young person thing.
I think the other thing that you pointed out at the top of the episode is that Alexandra Darcy is a Canadian, and the majority of the data she works with is from her corpora of Toronto English speakers, which are speakers in Toronto in Canada.
Yeah, again, one of the reasons I like this study, she's based in University of Victoria now, so she's also working with people in British Columbia and Canada, but this is something that at the very least is a feature of North American English. But for the particular case of the discourse marker-like that's at the beginning of the sentence, that one seems to have started in the British Isles and actually passed into North America around the 1950s and 60s. It's not this sort of like new young person thing, the Valley Girls in the 1980s.
I did find it interesting that she seems to think the best evidence we have for the quotative comes from the Valley Girl usage. And it's our perception of this one usage that has affected the way we see the usage of all of the other features as well.
Right, exactly. You know, like a lot of myths have sort of some grain of truth, but in this case, the grain of truth is a very small grain because this one particular usage of, and I was like, and he was like, does seem to increase in the 1980s. That one is sort of most common among the youngest speakers in her data, which again, 20 years later, I do think people who are using that who are in their 30s and 40s now, but not necessarily like I know people who are in their 60s, 70s who wouldn't use that usage, who would be using some of these other ones that have been around for hundreds of years. So there's one particular usage of like that did become more popular in the 1980s and does seem to at least kind of track the Valley Girl thing, but very much not exclusive to California. And again, is a bit more popular among young women, but not by a whole lot. So it's like this one thing, but that sort of bled over into all of these other uses of like, even the ones that were hundreds of years old.
Which is a really great way to kind of bring it full circle on this idea that Darcy has done so much work to bring so much evidence and create so much nuance about something where a lot of the public discourse, especially at the time, 15, 20 years ago, was pretty unnuanced about the way like was talked about.
Yeah, exactly. And there's always an XKCD about it. And this one doesn't cite Alex Darcy. There are other linguists who've also worked on like. We shouldn't be saying that Alex Darcy is the only linguist who's done it. She's just done quite a lot about like. And so there's an XKCD from 2015 where one of the characters says, I found this article on linguistics of the quotative like.
Like when you're like, she was like?
Yeah, it features a quote from a linguist, Patricia Q. Caravilla, who says, eventually all the people who hate this kind of thing are going to be dead, and the ones who use it are going to be in control.
Wow, turns out linguists are pretty hardcore.
I think she means dead from old age.
I'm going to start using like more, just in case.
And I think, you know, looking at an article like this 20 years later is a great demonstration of that, because you can say, oh, well, if it was primarily, you know, people in their 30s and 20s and teens who were using quotative like in the early 2000s, now it's very easy to say, okay, well, that's people who are in their 50s and younger who are using it. And you can just see that age-based change moving through the population.
Of course, the only way that she could write such an amazingly comprehensive article was to have an entire thesis and then a book's worth of research on this topic. So that's all there as well. If reading the article is not enough for you, there's even more substance behind her research. But it's such a wonderfully well-researched paper and such a great example of an academic showing their frustration in the politest and most evidence-based possible way.
It's also a really fun example about how a lot of the words that sort of capture the public imagination are sort of what I think of as like $10 words, you know, defenstrate, or, you know, Schadenfreude, or Flossenoss and Hilipilification, these sort of like long and fancy, maybe Latinate words or words with kind of complicated etymologies. But the thing that you can really write like a book and a dissertation and multiple papers on is often something that's a little bit simpler in terms of its origin and where it comes from and that we take it for granted, but that has all of these complex discourse things and these complex social change features that it goes through and all of these different contexts in which you find it in a sentence. And there's a whole lot going on there when you look at what you could think of as like the 1 cent words compared to the big $10 words like defenstrate.
And of course, with a 1 cent word like, you use it enough that those cents really start racking up. For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I tweet and blog as Superlinguo.
I can be found as @GretchenAMcSee on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com, and my book is Because Internet. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretch McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan. Our senior producer is Claire Gaughan. Our production editor is Sarah Dapirala. Our production assistant is Martha Tsutsui Billens. And our production manager is Liz McCullough. Our music is Ancient City by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
Stay Lingthusiastic!